First, for an update, though, on some vital unfolding issues in Africa that have been rather crowded out by other events. South Sudan, where such high hopes rested after the peace deal almost 2 years ago, is now back at war and facing solemn declarations of famine, virtually always associated with war, not as we once thought a natural calamity. This week, Serge Tissot from the UN Food and Agricultural Organization said that our worst fears have been realized. Many families, he said, have exhausted every means they have to survive. He and others believe this famine's potentially more devastating than in 2011, when more than 250,000 people are estimated to have died. 100,000 people are now facing starvation, with a further million on the brink of famine. Three other countries are looking at a similar fate: Yemen, Somalia, and Nigeria. All three have also been dealing with internal conflict, and that's another 4 million people concerned. So to offer us some context, I'm happy to welcome Siobhan O'Grady, who stepped out of her much safer environment as a Beltway writer contributing to Foreign Policy magazine, and she's gone right into the field, basing herself in Uganda, a country experiencing the brunt of the conflict, as South Sudanese seek refuge from the food crisis and the fighting, by the thousands, sometimes every day. Siobhan, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've seen firsthand what the situation's like there. I think you were there just a few months ago. Did you see evidence of both famine or famine-like conditions and the conflict?
Yes. Yeah, so I was actually in Unity State this past summer, and I definitely saw the beginnings of what we already at that time would have called famine. And actually, amongst colleagues, we were saying, you know, that it was just the lack of declaration that made it not a famine yet. It definitely was already famine-like conditions, but there are technical, you know, studies that have to be done in order to actually declare famine, including weighing children and actually counting how many people have died from starvation and a number of other criteria. So part of the problem was access in terms of declaring famine and why there was a delay. But absolutely, at that time, the civilians I was meeting, and this was in an area called Unity State, which is the hometown or the home region of rebel leader Riek Machar. And the civilians I was meeting were coming actually from his hometown of Lair and fleeing from government attacks in that town and heading to a sort of rebel stronghold nearby. Many of them were surviving on nothing more than water lily bulbs they were pulling from the swamp. Children were emaciated, adults were emaciated. And at that point, especially when children often suffer first in famine, but when you're at a point where adults are also dying from starvation, then the conditions are considered to have deteriorated to yet a new level. And I was meeting adults who had not had a real meal in many, many months. And many of them were struggling to provide for their families, even despite some airdrops of grain that had begun at that time. People were, even to access that grain, some people were having to wade through a dangerous swamp for hours at just to wait in line to be told the food ran out.
Yes, I think it's in your article or in one that I read, very vivid imagery of the drops, the food drops coming, and suddenly out of the bushes, all these thousands of people run towards them. They're hiding in the bushes. And you just suddenly see like ants coming to eat.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can hear when a food drop is coming, you can hear it so loudly. You're in a place that has actually in this region of South Sudan, there's no electricity, there's no cell tower. So people are really cut off from the rest of the world and it's quite quiet. So when you do hear something like the sound of an airdrop, people come running, but they're often turned away because the World Food Program then has to sort through this food and make sure and kind of arrange it. But people are standing there, you know, on the brink of starvation and being told they have to wait a few days because it does need to have some kind of organization. But at the same time, levels of starvation were quite frightening when I was there.
We've really been educated in the last generation about the link between famine and hostilities. But I take it that farmers are unable to plant or harvest crops. Is that part of the issue now because of fear of being caught up in the fighting?
Yes, absolutely. So many people have been displaced by this conflict. Millions have been displaced internally. More than a million have fled the country as refugees. And if you visit these areas, you can see that that places where crops may have once been planted are completely empty because over and over again, you know, whether you're living in a government-controlled area that's having attacks from the rebels or a rebel-controlled area having attacks by the government. And I should say that both sides have committed atrocities. It was a political disagreement that spiraled into a sort of ethnically fueled civil war. And but both sides have committed atrocities, but the government atrocities have been recorded as having been exponentially worse and more widespread, in part because they have more resources. But no matter which side you're living in, you're having to face constant fear of attack, and people are afraid to even go out to the farms to plant. And also, there's a lack of willpower, because why would you plant if you may just be displaced once again in a few weeks?
I mean, very quick, it's a power struggle, really, is it not, between the South Sudanese government forces and the rebels, who is actually the former vice president. You've got the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, I think it is, from the Dinka ethnic group, and his former vice president, Riek Machar, is it, who's a Nuer. And so, so this is both, well, it is the worst sort of ethnic, and it's religious as well, is it?
No, it's not religious. It's when South Sudan broke off from Sudan, the majority of South Sudanese are Christian, but the conflict is definitely a power struggle. In 2013, Salva Kiir claimed that Riek Machar, his vice president, and I should add, Salva Kiir was not democratically elected. He was appointed following independence. So many South Sudanese who disagree with him don't actually see him as a legitimate president, because at this point there has not been the election that was promised. And so he's essentially also overstaying his time in power. But he claimed that Riek Machar was plotting a coup and fired him. And by December 2013, troops, the National Army, which was had troops, some troops who share an ethnic group with Machar, some troops who share an ethnic group with Kiir, opened fire on each other in the capital, and immediately it turned to civilians. And Dinka soldiers loyal to the president were executing Nuer men in the streets of Juba. People were fleeing just as fast as they could to the UN base that was in the capital to kind of maintain peace after independence. And tens of thousands of people are still living on that base and in other bases around the country. So it just quickly spiraled from a kind of scuffle in the capital into a full-blown civil war. And it has had its moments where it's slowed down since, but there's been an uptick in fighting since July, and things are only poised to get worse.
What's the situation like in the refugee camps in Uganda, for instance, where you are?
Yes, so thousands of people cross the border every day. I don't think there's been many days that fewer than 1,000 have crossed. There have been some where as many as 8,000 people have crossed across the border. Just to put this kind of in context, more South Sudanese have fled to Uganda since July than refugees who fled across the Mediterranean last year in the entirety of 2016. So if you're used to seeing images of those boats crossing into Europe and people falling onto shore, they're horrible, but the scale is so much larger between South Sudan and Uganda. And people are often walking for days on foot, carrying infants on their back, children walking. And for a long time now, it's been mainly women and children who are crossing over the border, which has frightened people watching, because that can often mean that the men are staying behind to prepare for a fight, and that the family is just being sheltered in Uganda, but that there could be a massive uptick in actual ground fighting at home. But what I found when I was there just 2 weeks ago was that increasingly men were arriving. I saw far more men than I expected, and aid workers confirmed that they were having a large number of men arrive, which implied not only that maybe some of them, you know, want absolutely nothing to do with this civil war, of course, because that's how most civilians feel, but also that the move to Uganda is more permanent. When the male head of a household arrives, it can imply that there's no plan to go back.
740,000 South Sudanese refugees in Uganda who've arrived in the last 7 months. What staggering numbers.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild to see. I mean, just so many people pouring in, total chaos. People are sick and hungry and scared in many cases. And these, I should add, for the majority of them, they are not Dinka or Nuer, which is a development that has kind of shifted since late last spring and especially after July. They're living in the Equatorian region of South Sudan, which is the southern area that is, the states have been divided and renamed so many times over the past few years, but it was originally Central Equatoria was the name of this region. It's close to Uganda in relatively. So, I mean, it's a few days walk to the border, which is why so many people are choosing Uganda as their refuge point. But when Riek Machar returned under the peace deal from August 2015, he was living in the capital, had set up a camp there. I actually visited him there and interviewed him. And, you know, it seemed when I was there that there was a period of sort of relative calm in the capital, especially. And then in July, after another sort of scuffle in the capital, government forces ended up bombing Riek Machar's camp. He had to flee on foot. And while he ran to Congo, he passed through this region, which meant that a lot of rebel troops also followed. And there had kind of been some positioning for a while with the president slowly sending government troops to this area to sort of try to secure it and secure support there. Although, of course, sending troops there can kind of do the opposite.
Just in the couple of minutes we have left, you do write a heartbreaking story. I mean, several, in fact. One of thousands you've heard, no doubt. Last October, government soldiers killed a man in central Equatorial, and his brother-in-law was thankful he was at work because he survived. But the rebel fighters, you say, didn't see it that way. They thought he was a government collaborator, and they executed him in front of his wife and two young children. Now, I mean, when you hear that, I mean, there really isn't any other option but to run, is there?
Exactly. I mean, can you imagine how that woman felt? The other families running, they're leaving and they're mainly walking on routes that are either unoccupied or are controlled by the rebels. And I have to say, it just to allow listeners to imagine this, when you're standing on the Uganda side of the border, there is at one of the border crossings I visited called the Busia border crossing, there are a few Ugandan police officers on one side, and on the other, there are rebel soldiers standing with loaded AK-47s, some of them wearing pajamas, wearing slacks, not even wearing uniforms in most cases, and they're controlling who has the right to cross over the border. And as soon as they're over that tiny bridge, then they're declared a refugee and Uganda moves them to a settlement. But for people walking that route who have been attacked by government troops, there is a sense of safety that the rebels will at least let them cross. But for that woman, she was terrified to even take that route. She ended up taking a very extensive route through Congo, having to put her young children onto a motorbike and send them alone with a man she barely knew, hoping that he would take them to safety. And thankfully he did. He did, although he robbed them of everything they had first. So there's just no end to the horrors for so many of these people who are completely innocent, farmers, teachers, students whose lives have just been completely turned upside down by a conflict that has nothing to do with them.
Well, I notice our foreign minister said that the Australian government had contributed an additional $20 million towards helping people. And, of course, everyone's wondering whether this is going to be China's moment to step in and behave in a very diplomatic fashion. We'll follow that story. Siobhan O'Grady, thank you very much indeed for those observations.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Siobhan is a freelance journalist. She works across sub-Saharan Africa now. She's based herself in Uganda, and she's a contributor for Foreign Policy. And if you go to our website, we have a link to UN Refugees, where you can make a donation if you'd like to do so, as well as to Australian Red Cross. And I'm sure there'll be others collecting as sort of word properly spreads about this, if you have a preferred charity to donate.
This Is About is a podcast hosted by Jordan Raskopoulos. That's me. Stories told by those who live them.
To do a good job, you kind of have to believe that you're Spider-Man.
He was holding what he claimed was Ned Kelly's skull.
She just said to me, if you can't have this baby, I'll have a baby for you.
What I thought was two different dolphins was just one shark.
What?
This Is About on the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts.
Listen now.
On your phone.
You know, just do the thumb thing.